I'm gonna, I know we're going to get to the end, and I'm going to feel
like the most essential thing I haven't told you. So this time, despite my tendency to dwell for the first 40 minutes of a given lecture on the thing that I said I was going to cover for 5 minutes at the end of the previous lecture, I am going to actually only cover for 5 minutes the final point about the CMV. So the last lecture, right, the basic point was just say on the back of the envelope, you know, you could calculate roughly at what temperature the neutrons would fall out of thermal equilibrium in the early universe and cease to drop and cease to become rare relative to the protons. And then a little bit later, you could on the back of the envelope calculate a slightly lower temperature at which it finally got cold enough for all of those neutrons to bind up with protons into helium atoms. And that's basically what happens. That's where all the neutrons go. And so if you take the abundance of neutrons, the fractional abundance of 1/7 that was left at that freeze-out temperature, put those all into helium nuclei and calculate what the fraction of the universe is in helium, you find that it's about 25% helium and the rest hydrogen. And then you say, that sounds about right. Let me go back and do a more complicated computer calculation to follow in more detail the evolution of the nuclear abundances. And you find predictions for all of isotopes of all of the first four elements in the periodic table. You compare as many of those as you can with observation. And you find it does surprisingly well. And you say, my God, this model, you know, the same physics that we infer in terrestrial laboratories is actually describing the universe when it was a billion times smaller than it is today, or the volume was 10 to the 27 times smaller than it was today. So you're basically when the universe was so dense that it was like roughly as dense as a nucleus. So that is the idea of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And then with the CMV, we said a very similar line of reasoning, but just applied later and at lower temperatures. So this all took place at a temperature of about 1 MeV when the universe was only 1 second to about a minute old. And was only about 10 to the minus 9 of its present size. But then later on, when the temperature is more like 1 EV, and the universe is a few hundred thousand years old, and as we will see, the scale factor was only about 10 to the minus 3 of its present value. So the universe was about 1/1,000,000,000 of the present volume. The temperature finally got cool enough for all of the protons and electrons to combine into neutral hydrogen. At that moment, the photons, which had been happily bouncing off of electrons, had nothing left to bounce off of. But they remained happy. They just happily streamed across the universe at that point. And you observe those today as the cosmic microwave background. And the only only final point I wanted to make about this was we had shown in an earlier lecture that when you have radiation in thermal equilibrium, where the photons are bouncing around like crazy, that their temperature drops proportional to 1 upon A. And now I just want to briefly explain why this rule continues to be the case even after the photons cease to scatter. Their temperature continues to drop as if they were still in thermal equilibrium by the following simple argument. So we said that the Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution function um, So in general, it would be E minus mu over T minus plus 1. But here we're talking about photons now. If that had only been done in between, that could have supplanted the joke that I am worried is not that great today. But anyway, but you did your best. It's my fault that the joke isn't good. So we're talking about photons, so those are bosons. So I will get rid of the plus sign here. Photons also have zero chemical potential, as I argued last time. And then their energy is just equal to the magnitude of their momentum. Okay, so now let's consider some little, right before recombination happened, the photons were in thermal equilibrium. They had this distribution function with some temperature T initial, okay? And then we're looking at some little volume with so this is P and X. And so let's say we're looking at some initial volume. It doesn't matter where it is in space because everywhere in space is the same, but we're looking at some initial momentum PI. And so there's some, according to this formula, there's some number of photons in this blob, given by this thermal formula, and then suddenly they're not scattering against anything anymore. They're just moving along geodesics. So what will happen to all of the photons in this blob as they move along geodesics? So they will move to some other, they'll move to some other blob. Okay. Yeah. So this is not. I don't mean they move to negative momentum. I just mean so all of their momenta, all of the momenta, spatial momenta of the photons that were in this blob, they all redshift as 1 upon A. So PI ends up some blob down here, P final, with momentum P final. But Since all of the momenta, their magnitudes are redshifting, is when we said that for photons, well, for any particle, but photons in particular, that the magnitude of their momentum redshifts as 1 upon A. So if I draw, you know, where all of the photons in this box, including the boundaries of the box, went, you know, you can imagine it going to, well, the volume has increased. The volume of the universe has increased by a factor of a cubed. So this direction of the box has been stretched by a factor of a cubed. This direction has been squashed by a factor of a cubed because the momenta have decreased by a factor of a cubed. So anyway, they end up at some final momenta and located in some long, thin box now. But anyway, the same number that we're in here is the number that we're in here, and so. So that's that number. But alternatively, we could write what the expected thermal number is here. Somehow, even though this is actually an easy point, I'm going to manage to make it confusing. I can already see it coming. So what I'm trying to say is that there's two ways you could go about calculating the number density of particles in this volume and phase space. On the one hand, you could write down the thermal distribution at some temperature T final at this value of momentum P final and get this expression. On the other hand, you could take this earlier box and just say, I evolve it to this new position with these new D3Ps and D3Xs, but the number is the same as it was here, and so the number is given by this. But I just argued to you that since this guy gets scaled up by a factor of A cubed, gets scaled down by a factor of A cubed, and this guy gets scaled up by a factor of A cubed, the numerators here are equal. And whereas the denominator, I know that pi has just been redshifted by a factor of A in going down to pf here. In other words, I've defined the final volumes to just be the final volume to be the same as the redshifted one, so I can drop the subscripts and P final is just P initial divided by A. It's just redshifted. And so if I want these two expressions to be equal, they will be equal as long as TF is just TI divided by A. Okay, so in other words, I managed to blow that. But what I'm trying to say is that because in this form, the only place where these two things both scale as just simple power laws in A that cancel against each other. So the redshifting with A is not going to change anything about the form of the numerator, and the only thing that the redshifting with A the only thing that the expansion of the universe changes according to the geodesic formula in the numerator, in the denominator, is an overall rescaling of P. But since P and T appear in this simple combination, a corresponding that can just be absorbed into a corresponding rescaling of the temperature. So that in other words, if you take any volume in the initial phase space at time ti and temperature capital Ti, evolve it forward and look at how many particles that would mean per unit volume at some other point p final at time t final, that is exactly the same number of particles as you would have calculated at that p final if you had used a new temperature t final, which is t initial over A. Okay? It's the sort of thing it's clear to nobody. And yet I swear to you that if you just take 2 minutes and think about the argument that I just gave after class, it will be clear to everybody. Go ahead.
So you're saying that the number of photons in the polynomial is conserved.
That's true. So that's true. So the geodesic equation acts as a Hamiltonian evolution in phase space. So that is true what you say. So the main thing is that the Hamiltonian evolution. But the main thing is that the particle trajectories aren't let's see. I guess I assumed that. I mean, the only thing that I am thinking of using in this argument is just that if I take a little infinitesimal volume and follow all the trajectories in it, that they will wind up in another little infinitesimal volume all near the same place. So I'm assuming, I don't think I'm even using the fact that they're not crossing or that this volume is preserved. I mean, I just derived that because this goes down to z cubed and this goes up to z cubed, the volume is preserved. But I don't think I'm assuming much about.
I wasn't talking about the volume of this place, I was talking about the number of photons in it.
Right, but that's just, in other words, that's the physical setup is that the physical setup is that right before the hydrogen atoms recombined, there were some number of photons, and then right afterwards, what I'm asking you to believe is that right afterwards, that the spectrum of photons at the moment right before the hydrogen recombined is approximately equal to the spectrum right after it recombined. So it's still the thermal spectrum at that instant. And then the next statement is that if you just let all of those photons stream along geodesics, so each individual photon there's no new photons being created, no photons being destroyed, each photon is just being allowed to move along geodesics, then the argument was that geodesic flow of photons preserves the thermal form of the spectrum, with the only modification being that the temperature goes down as 1 upon A. So you're right. You're right that, That's right. One of the inputs is that what we're talking about is everything moving along geodesics, no new photons being created, none of the photons disappearing. To finish, you know, what Gamov could have done, and I don't know if he did this or not, but he could have said, okay, from my Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculation, I don't think he could have done this to any good degree of accuracy, but I could be wrong. He could have said, to get the abundances right here, I had to choose some particular value for what we were calling eta, the number density of baryons divided by the number density of photons. This number that was about a billion, but you can actually figure it out because if it's too different from the correct value from this one in a billion value, then you get the wrong predicted abundances for helium and especially deuterium. So he could say, not only do I predict that the universe should still be full of a thermal spectrum of freely streaming photons, but I look around me and I can count up by looking at how much starlight I see and converting that into how much stellar mass it corresponds to and looking at how much gas I can count up through various astronomical observations. People make estimates of how many atoms there are floating around in the universe today. And so I can use this ratio to convert the number of atoms in the universe today to the number of photons in the universe today. But the number of photons in the universe today, since it still has a thermal spectrum, is still given by our order one factor, whatever it is, zeta of 3 over pi squared or something, times t cubed today. And so by that argument, he could have figured out that not only should there be a bath of photons in the universe today, but it should have a temperature of roughly a few Kelvin. Okay. Again, the argument is if you take the number of baryons, number of atoms from the periodic table, observed in the number density of normal matter observed in the universe today, and stars and gas and just the stuff you can see through telescopes, multiply that times a billion to get the number of photons and ask what temperature do I need to get a billion photons, to get that number density of photons. It turns out to be a temperature of a few Kelvin. And so finally, if the temperature is a few Kelvin today, you know, it turns out to be 3 Kelvin, and we said that we found through our back of the envelope calculation last time that the temperature had to be Well, we calculated in EV, but if you just change units, it turns out to be 3,500 Kelvin or something like that. That says that this that now tells you that this decoupling event happened when the temperature was about a factor of 1,000 higher than it is today. So in other words, when A was a factor of about 1,000 smaller than it is today. Okay? Okay. I'm going to have to pull out the joke early, I'm afraid to say. A man, I should have left while I was, I should have just quit while I was ahead with that BBN and CMB stuff. It was, in my opinion, you guys were excited about that for one lecture, and then I overdid it with this extra 15 minutes. But okay. But who knows? I would love to know that that's not true. But, so a husband and wife are sitting at a table, and the wife says, "Husband, you are as dumb as this table." And the husband says, "Dear, I think someone is at the door." And the wife says, "Idiot, just stay here. I'll go get it." Okay. It really is just so gratifying when you laugh at those jokes. Okay. So now dark matter. Yeah.
So our evidence for that the universe is expanding to us both, you know, we look at and we see that
that's right.
That's
right. So the correct abundance of the light elements, the fact that there's 25% of the universe is helium and the right amount is deuterium, and that's one bit of evidence. Then a more or less independent bit of evidence is that you see a bath of freely streaming photons through the universe today, with a thermal spectrum, with about the temperature that you would have predicted from your previous Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculation. So it hangs together with your previous expanding model. And then there is this separate thing, like you say, that the original way that it was discovered still remains a good bit of evidence, which is that if you look out at galaxies further and further away, they are moving away faster as they're more and more redshifted, i.e. they forget what I said about they're moving away faster. I mean, so that is a good interpretation locally, but let's to say it in the way that we had explained it before. Yes, if you look out at further and further galaxies, meaning their light had to be emitted earlier and earlier, you see that their spectra are more and more redshifted as you would predict from expanding universe. So those are sort of three of the classic bits of evidence. And they test the consistency of the theory at different times. BBN is the earliest of those three by far, and then CMB is really also quite early. And then the galaxies that you're looking at, those are at much more recent times. Those galaxies are correspond to maybe they only emitted their light towards you a billion years ago, whereas the universe was already 9 billion years old, let's say, when one of those galaxies emitted its light to you. So dark matter. I'm writing dark matter over here with a line under it as a declaration that I'm about to... It's going to be a new day in terms of board organization. So in the 1970s, so in the 20th century, accelerator experiments produced all sorts of great hints, and then suddenly in the 1970s, they had the Standard Model of Particle Physics, and everyone was like, "This is great. This explains everything. It explains all the experiments we can do." On the other hand, this is terrible. There are all sorts of embarrassing things about this model. Surely, forthcoming experiments will reveal a less embarrassing improvement upon the Standard Model. And then, famously, what actually happened were that decades of collider experiments revealed no problems with the Standard Model. And so today, we have all the same embarrassing problems that we did in the 1970s. And any of the hints that we did get came from more sort of unexpected, you know, any of the hints for beyond the Standard Model came from unexpected places, like dark matter and dark energy. We learned about those from astrophysical observations, and the fact that neutrinos have mass, we also learned about from astrophysical observations, and then from underground detectors. But there's a similar thing now in cosmology, which is that since about 2000, there was this picture that was developed where the universe had, roughly speaking, So the bottom line is it's an analogous picture. It's even called, whereas in analogy with the Standard Model of Particle Physics, it's called the Standard Model of Cosmology. It has just really a handful of tunable parameters in it, but it's extremely successful in explaining all of the data that people collect. But like the Standard Model, it's theoretically embarrassing because, first of all, so two of the parameters, the two of the key parameters you have to put in are the abundance of dark matter, which is something like 25% of the energy density in the universe at the present time. That's what you have to fix that parameter to. So one of the tunable parameters is how much dark matter there is. And you have to fix that to about 25% of the present critical density. Remember, the critical density was this thing the present 3 times the present Hubble scale over 8 pi g. That's the density that you would need to make the universe exactly spatially flat today. And then rho dark energy. There's some other component called dark energy, which appears to have about 70% of the critical density today. And then you and me and our atoms and all the atoms in the periodic table, rho normal baryonic matter. So, standard terminology in cosmology is just to call everything all normal matter that you would ever find in the periodic table or in the Standard Model of Particle Physics, for that matter, baryonic matter. So rho baryonic is only like 4 or 5%. If you work on the Standard Model of Particle Physics, okay, so you know when you tell other physicists that they will understand that there are embarrassing things about your model. But to the person on the street, what you're doing still sounds very sophisticated and sounds like it hangs together well. But I mean, any cosmologist will have encountered the fact that when you tell people that, 95% of the universe is in these other components that you have no idea what they are, and you've just made them up to fit the data, they will, even the guy on the street knows to look at you like out of politeness I won't say this, but you're obviously like the guy who put the ether in before Einstein came along and found a more elegant explanation of what was going on, so that may be true. Especially with this, that may be true. With this guy, it's possible. But it's increasingly, no one has come along with a so far. No Einstein has come along yet with a model that works better than this. I encourage any of you to be that person. But I will try to explain briefly why that is harder in this case than it is in this case, where there's still, I would say, very good opportunity for that to be how it turns out. So briefly explain why we seem to need this, and then what are the sort of basic ideas about where this might be coming from, what this is. So dark matter was originally discovered in the 30s. The first hint of it was in the 30s. This guy Fritz Zwicky, famously ornery character, was observing, who did a lot of great stuff, was observing clusters of galaxies. So you look up in the sky, most galaxies, maybe, yeah. Leptons, yes, exactly. So that's the thing. So particle physicists, by baryons, they mean things that interact with color. Whereas here, yeah. Bound states due to color, mesons and baryons. But here we just mean, basically, here, there are various astronomical terms that are, well, let's call it perversions of their proper meaning. So you look up in the sky and a lot of the galaxies that you see are just in the field with nobody else around, but then occasionally you will, in certain places on the sky, you will see a clump of 100 galaxies right next to one another that are bound into a gravitational ball of galaxies. And Zwicky looked up at these things and he could measure how much total light they were emitting, and he could estimate based on that how much total matter there was in stars emitting that light. But then he could also, by looking at how redshifted or blue-shifted their spectra were, he could see how fast they were moving towards him and away from him. And so he could get an estimate of how fast the galaxies were swirling around in the cluster. And the bottom line is they were swirling much too fast. The typical velocities at which the galaxies and the clusters were moving were much too high to be explained as being held gravitationally bound together by the estimated mass contained in the stars that he was looking at. Yeah.
Doesn't this imply that he solved the black body problem?
You can just use the Virial theorem for a man. I mean, it's like a, yeah. So you know, roughly speaking, that. That b squared over r, b squared over the typical size of the cluster, has to be, unless it's a very specially arranged configuration, has to be equal to. Let's see, has to be gm over the g times the total mass of the cluster over of order of magnitude. And the point is, B was much bigger than would be predicted, than this relation would predict, based on the M that he estimated from these stars corresponding to the starlight that he saw. Okay, and then later there was a second of the sort of classic observations was an astronomer, Vera Rubin, did. There's sort of two main types of galaxies, and one type of galaxy are spiral galaxies, and so our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy, and so the basic idea there is that they have a sort of little ball of stars in the middle, the so-called bulge, where those are just moving randomly, but then they're surrounded by a disk of stars that are all sort of orbiting in a pancake in the same direction. And so if you look at these spiral galaxies and you plot, so let's say we now draw axes over the spiral galaxy, and I'll measure these stars over here all seem to be moving away from me. These stars over here all seem to be moving toward me, and I can measure by looking at how redshifted these spectra are and blue-shifted these spectra are. I can see how fast this side is moving away and how fast this side is moving toward me. And I can plot that velocity as a function of the radius from the center of the galaxy. And so if the mass of the galaxy, so the thing that's causing the stars to orbit around the center of the galaxy is just the overall mass contained within those orbits, you know, pulling them into a circular orbit. And if that mass was all due to the observable stars in the galaxy, then you can estimate, you know, how much mass there is as a function of radius in this galaxy and predict what is the expected velocity as a function of radius. And the velocity as a function of radius from the galaxy, you expect it to go up, but then once you get to the outer edge of the disk, where where all of the light goes away, if that was really, if that really meant all the mass was ending there, you would then expect the velocities to drop to zero again at larger radii. But instead, what he found for galaxy after galaxy was that the velocities plateaued at larger radii. So you can still, so even though the bulk, even though the light being emitted by the galaxy is dominated by this disk that ends here, and so hypothetically, according to this hypothesis, the mass would also be dominated, the observed baryonic mass would also be dominated by something that only has about that extent. You can still see some stars out here. They get much rarer, but you can still see enough stars that you can still measure a rotation curve. This is called a rotation curve that you're supposed to see. Again, the predicted rotation curve would go like that. The actual thing has two plateaus. So again, the statement is that the velocities of the stars out here and out here are much too large to be accounted for by the observed stellar mass inferred by the observed light. So those are sort of the classic astronomical tests. Since the 80s, and then even more so since the 90s, and since the mid 2000s, you know, the evidence has become dramatically stronger, and just many more, unsummarizably many independent lines of evidence seem to point to the baryons not being enough in various contexts, and the need for extra non-baryonic, extra matter that isn't behaving like baryons. And the most, you know, the strongest example comes from something that we'll talk about next week, which is the statistics of perturbations in the cosmic microwave background. So to make a long story short, you with dark matter, you predict some curve for some statistical property of the cosmic microwave background radiation, whose temperature looks slightly different in different directions on the sky, and you can fit this model with these several parameters, including dark matter density and baryon density and dark energy density. You can fit it to the observed curve, and so the predicted curve perfectly fits the observed curve when the dark matter density is something like 25% of the critical density. It is horrendously disfavored. It's completely wrong if you try to set the dark matter density to zero and twiddle the other parameters to try to find the best fit to the CMB data in the absence of dark matter. So statistically speaking, this is by far our best evidence. Now you might say, so maybe you need extra matter beyond the baryons that you observe, beyond the 5% of baryons you observe. And I should say a key point is, just without summarizing everything, the thing that makes it harder and harder to get around this being an extra component of matter that is just hard to see, but that is basically cold, non-relativistic matter that behaves effectively like a gas of cold, non-relativistic particles, is just that hypothesis now agrees with a lot of different tests that are really qualitatively very different from one another, but that many of which have their best fit value agreeing with the same, you know, checking out at this same value of the dark matter density. So it's just hard. I mean, but on the other hand, until you've actually seen a dark matter particle, never say never. But there, any alternative theory has to do a difficult job of fitting the web of tests. What you might say is, well, aren't really all these tests One thing you can say is that really what these tests are saying is that the extra baryons, in addition to the non-relativistic matter accounted for today by the baryons that you observe, maybe the rest of this is you need another factor of 5 or 6 in additional non-relativistic, additional stuff that behaves like a non-relativistic gas of particles. But you just can't see it. Something is preventing you from seeing it. So maybe this is just baryonic matter, but it's just in a form that you can't see. You know, maybe it's very dilute it's a very dilute gas that just hasn't clumped into stars that you would be able to see, or maybe it's a lot of baryons that have been collapsed into black holes that are now totally invisible to us, or something like that. And the answer to that is that you pretty much can't get away with that either. So the first thing to say is that Big Bang nucleosynthesis, again, it predicts a value for eta. So today you observe the temperature of the CMB today. It's 3 degrees Kelvin. Then that corresponds to a number density of photons today. And to get the light element abundances right, the amount of hydrogen and helium and deuterium right, you had to set eta to some particular value, one in a billion. So if you take the number density of photons and convert it to the number density of baryons, using that one in a billion factor from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, you get a baryon density today that matches this value, not this value plus this value. Okay, if you tried to change the baryon to photon ratio from 1 in a billion to 6 or 7 times a billion, times 1 in a billion, in order to include this stuff too, you would get completely the wrong predicted light element abundances. You would get completely the wrong deuterium abundance. So you can't really do that. You could say maybe I could collapse it all into black holes before Big Bang nucleosynthesis happened. You know, maybe somehow before time of 1 second, some mysterious process took 6/7 of the baryons and collapsed them into black holes so that they were out of the way, already secluded, before Big Bang nucleosynthesis happened. And so maybe that way you could preserve the light element abundances but still have the universe full of black holes today. The dark matter today just be a lot of black holes floating around that really ultimately are accounted for by baryons. And that is one version of what is called the... So the first thing to say about that is that it's very hard to collapse anything early in the radiation dominated era. Nothing begins to collapse, as far as we can understand, until after the universe has stopped being radiation dominated and has started being matter dominated. But to give you the other reason to disbelieve that possibility. Not that it's, as I'll say, it's not entirely ruled out, but to the other reason that is disfavored has to do with constraints on what are called machos. So let me now begin to categorize for you what. So let's take the viewpoint that there is dark matter, that you can't get around to adding some extra dark matter, and then ask, what could it be, and what possibilities can you rule out? So the first thing you might ask, the first distinction that people drew between two different possible types of dark matter is between WIMPs and machos. So WIMPs versus machos. So this is just some clever cosmologist, not George Gamow, but someone carrying on his spirit. These are weakly interacting massive particles. So, in other words, this is just the general name for the idea that this extra dark matter is a particle just like the proton or the neutron. It's some other massive particle floating around in the universe. It's just that it doesn't interact with the electromagnetic force. It probably doesn't interact with the strong force, and so it's floating around out there. But it turns out that if it interacts only via the weak force, or maybe even weaker than the weak force, then it's consistent with us not having seen it until today. But it's fundamentally a particle. It's a fundamental particle, and it's just waiting to be discovered somehow. Versus machos, this is the idea that it's matter clumped into macroscopic objects like black holes or just other compact objects that are just not shining, so you can't see them. So maybe a completely cold neutron star would be another example of a macho candidate. So the first point that I want to make is that although machos are not entirely ruled out, they have been mostly ruled out. And the most important thing that was realized about them was that that this great astronomer Bodin Puschinski, this is one of my favorite guys, although I can't spell his last name, but I don't know, that's not right. There's probably a Z in there. He's Polish. I can't spell Polish names. But Bodin Puschinski pointed out that if the dark matter was this stuff, so we said that spiral galaxies are observed to be engulfed in a halo of dark matter that is necessary in order to account for the fact that the rotation curves plateau rather than falling off at large distances. But so if our Milky Way galaxy was engulfed in such a halo, because our Milky Way galaxy, it's harder to observe from within your own galaxy, but anyway. So all spiral galaxies show this trend. So the logic is, if our Milky Way galaxy is engulfed in a similar halo, then you should be able to see, if they're machos, you should be able to see them by a technique called gravitational microlensing. So gravitational microlensing is, if you have a background star, if you're looking at a background star, and a foreground macho, so you're looking this way, monitoring this star, the starlight is constant, the brightness of that star is constant, but then let's say a black hole passes in front of it, a little black hole, so the star is sending out rays in all directions, but as the black hole passes in front of it, general relativity says the rays have a little bit of a tendency to curve around the black hole. They tend to curve a little bit toward you. And so as the black hole passes in front of the star, you see a little brief rise in the intensity coming from the star. So this is intensity as a function of time here. Okay, so the star is just sitting there, and then you don't see this object, but what you do see is you see that as it passes in front of the star that you're looking at, the star gets a little bit brighter for a little while the star passes in front, and then returns back to its normal brightness. So he pointed this out and suggested a campaign of just monitoring a lot of stars outside in nearby galaxies, and seeing if you can see any of these microlensing events due to passing black holes. And so that has, or passing any sort of compact dark object in front of the star, and due to the lack of observed events, those experiments were able to rule out machos in the range between 10 to the minus 8 times the mass of our sun and 10 to the 2 times the mass of our sun. So over 10 orders of magnitude, you were able to rule that out. So there is still a window, so it's very hard to form. It's very hard to know how, because of the Big Bang nucleosynthesis arguments that I was talking about. As you get down below this, it becomes very hard to see how you could form those unless you. Well, I don't want to make too strong a statement. So this argument, together with an argument that also rules out, so there's a gap of like 10 orders of magnitude, but then also masses of 10 to the minus 18 solar masses or smaller are also ruled out by the fact that if they were by the fact that if they were a black hole, they would Hawking evaporate in less than the age of the universe, and so they wouldn't stick around to be the dark matter. So there is this window here. Nobody has a plausible suggestion for how to make objects in this window, but nevertheless, it hasn't been actually observationally ruled out. Objects bigger than this would be then talking about so-called intermediate mass black holes, and so people have been looking for those, and it's possible that there will be some black holes of this in this range bigger than 100 solar masses, but it's inconceivable that as I always have a tendency to make a stronger statement about these things than so. Really, the only range that's ruled out is this, and then 10 to the minus 18 and lower. Outside of that range, you may still have room to play games. Nobody has any good idea about how you would actually form a realistic dark matter candidate outside of those ranges. So it's fair to say that that machos are disfavored. They've become less and less interesting as time goes on, as opposed to more and more interesting. Now, everything we've learned about them has all been in the direction of ruling them out. No either theoretical or experimental progress has led in the direction of ruling them in. I guess that's what you would say. So WIMPs. So what about WIMPs? So here the situation is better. I'm not saying we know it's WIMPs. I'm just saying if I were going to put my money on something, me. I don't recommend that any of you put your money on anything, of course. Far be it for me to recommend gambling but if I were going to put my money on something, I would put it on WIMPs. And in particular, so then if it's WIMPs, what could it be? So again, there's a useful classification into basically two possibilities here. One possibility is that these WIMPs were produced, their abundance today was set by a freeze-out event, a decoupling event, like the one that I described a couple of lectures ago, that's the situation where there's some particle chi, and when the temperature in the early universe drops below the mass of the chi particle, thermal equilibrium wants to suppress the density of chi particles, and so it starts to suppress them maybe, but eventually these particles, even though they started in thermal equilibrium, can no longer maintain thermal equilibrium. They freeze out, they decouple from the thermal path, and after that, after that their number density is fixed. They hang around until the present day, and that's what sets their current abundance. So the type of WIMP that originally was in thermal equilibrium and then eventually couldn't remain in thermal equilibrium, and its abundance today is set by the moment at which it decoupled. Those are called thermal WIMPs. And then anything whose abundance is set by just some completely different process that has nothing to do with the idea that they were originally in thermal equilibrium and fell out of thermal equilibrium are called non-thermal WIMPs. Okay, and the famous example of a thermal WIMP, the leading, the canonical example of a non-thermal WIMP, I should say, is the axion. Whereas for thermal WIMPs, again, there's two really quite different cases. There's the case where the decoupling happens in the way that I described here, it happens because the temperature has fallen below the mass of the particle. So the decoupling happens when the temperature is less than the mass of the particle. So those are called cold thermal wimps. That's illegible. Those are called cold thermal wimps. And the opposite case, where the decoupling happens not because the temperature has fallen below the mass of the particle, but rather the temperature is still above the mass of the particle. The particle decouples when it's still relativistic. It's just that the universe is diluting, and so whatever reaction was necessary for maintaining thermal equilibrium is getting rarer for that reason. Those are called hot thermal wimps. That corresponds to decoupling when the temperature is high relative to the mass of the particle. So here, there's a canonical example of a hot thermal wimp. It is none other than your old friend, the neutrino, okay, which once upon a time was a legitimate dark matter candidate, even though it's been ruled out now. And then the canonical example of a cold thermal wimp is the lightest supersymmetric particle. Okay? And if I had any money left to bet after betting on wimps generally, I don't know if I would bet on this exactly, but I would bet on the cold thermal wimp because the hot thermal wimp turns out is observationally disfavored for a reason that I'll explain at the beginning of next class. The axion is, okay, people have been searching for it. A lot of the relevant parameter space has been ruled out. But it's not ruled out. It could be there. It was motivated originally by a good idea in particle physics. So, you know, a good idea in particle physics that could lead to a legitimate dark matter candidate that isn't ruled out yet, that's always something to keep your eye on. But here there's the actual thing called the wimp miracle. There's an actual calculation that you do where things check out in such a way that it seems like the universe is giving you a hint that this could be the right thing. Okay, so this candidate, you know, this candidate is also motivated by particle physics. As I say, there's just like there's an idea, Pecci-Quinn symmetry breaking, that leads to this particle, the axion, that was motivated by solving a problem in particle physics in the Standard Model. So here, also supersymmetry, of course, famously one of the things that it is supposed to do is solve problems with the Standard Model, and it predicts a candidate too, but it's in this category that has this additional wimp miracle that occurs. And that's the thing that I will outline at the beginning of next class and then is treated in more detail in the problem set. Yeah? So, so when you're writing down all of the terms that you can in the Standard Model, so you for each of the gauge fields in the Standard Model, you form a field strength, and that thing is gauge invariant. And so then you're instructed to write down every renormalizable term you can construct out of it that is also Lorentz invariant. And one of the things that you can write down is the normal kinetic term for the gauge field, which looks like that. That's true for any of the gauge fields. But the other thing you can write down is like f mu nu rho sigma times the epsilon tensor times the totally antisymmetric tensor mu nu rho sigma. So this is, in other words, this is called f times f dual. This whole thing is f dual mu nu. So at the classical level, terms like this, even though you can write them down and they're gauge invariant and Lorentz invariant, they don't contribute to the equations of motion. You can show that this term is a total derivative, and so when you take the variation of the action, it doesn't contribute and it doesn't modify the equations of motion at all. But at the quantum level, these terms turn out to not be innocuous, and in particular, for the strong force, this a term like this will inevitably be generated by quantum effects in the Standard Model, so-called so-called instanton effects with an order one coefficient in general. I mean, unless there's some symmetry to forbid it, QCD effects will generate this term. And the presence of this term, although it doesn't modify the classical equations of motion, will give rise to unacceptable experimental consequences at the quantum level, including an electric dipole moment for the neutron, but there's exceptionally good experimental constraints on an electric dipole for the neutron. It's zero to absurd accuracy. So, in fact, experimentally, in other words, what we know is that this parameter has to be less than or equal to 10 to the minus 9, roughly. And the question is why. So in short, there was the Pecci Quinn. There was this idea due to Pecci and Quinn in the late 70s. Well, I have to. What is the short route to saying? So, in short, the idea is you augment the standard model. So, in addition to the three gauge symmetries you thought you should put in, you give it one more global symmetry called Pecci-Quinn symmetry, and then you add a coupling. You add a new scalar field with one of these bottom of the wine bottle potentials, just like the Higgs, just roughly speaking, like the Higgs has. And so the idea of the model, is you introduce this extra U1 global symmetry and an extra scalar field. And then, so now instead of being a constant, this is some field, and the model turns out to dynamically relax this field to theta equals zero in the vacuum state. So it's supposed to give a dynamical explanation for why you don't observe an electric dipole moment for the neutron. But, so, but the bottom of the potential here, basically this is not a good explanation. So the axion is the field that is the component of this complex field that runs around the bottom here. So the bottom, I drew it as flat, but the whole idea is that to pin this field at some particular value here, the potential gets tipped a little bit like this. So as you go around in this direction, the potential, even though you're not really going around at a constant value of the potential, you're going up and then back down. And so there's a sort of cosine dependence of the potential on this axion field. And so that's what the axion field is. It ultimately boils down to this mechanism, which was originally motivated by solving this experimental problem, gives you an extra scalar field, or pseudo-scalar field, it turns out, with a cosine potential. And the idea is that for suitable choices of the parameters in that potential, that thing can give the right dark matter abundance. But there's no particular reason that the parameters in that potential have to be the right values to give you the dark matter abundance. So in that sense, it's not as nice. There's nothing analogously quite as nice as this thing in the case of the lightest supersymmetric particle. So that was all I was going to say, by the way. Unless there are more questions, yeah.
So about the axion, the potential that you drew. I mean, doesn't seem natural that why that would lead to theta having a very small value, right?
So you're
talking. Is that a result of the coupling with the FF term? Or not?
Yes. I mean, what I can't do now is explain in detail why this guy ends up at the value of theta equals zero. Yeah. But so, by the way, this is not theta equals zero. That's one. You should roughly think of this theta as this angular direction. And so it's the statement is that you can show that the potential tilts in such a way to pin you at the angle corresponding to phase equals zero. A non-confusing explanation of that would require a separate set of functions.
So there'll be a tutorial today about maybe 1:15 on Friday-ish. After lunch.
Wouldn't they be able to rule out anything from, like, above a certain sign?
So,